Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. In January of this year, Graham, Nigel and myself ran a war game to investigate and try and validate the new tactics we were developing for a new medium brigade fighting in Europe as part of a divisional war fighting operation. So Graham has asked us to give you an insight into this. I am, by trade, a cavalry officer, so we've kept the structure fairly simple. I will brief you about the requirement that we set as the customer. Nigel will then explain how he, as a professional scientist, delivered that war game. And then I'll come at the end and, as the customer, give you some idea of what we thought of the services that Nigel and Graham provided. And some of the insights we got from the game. So just to give you a brief idea of what our requirement was. It was, as I say, looking at the tactics for a new medium brigade operating in Europe. So one of the first things we needed to do is to look at how the brigade could operate as an advanced force with great speed of assembly, punching across Europe to join a rapidly assembling multinational coalition to deter a threat and to reassure the host nation allies. We then moved the war game on and looked at a number of hypotheses we had about how that brigade could fight within a British division, within a large NATO force, with the brigade conducting covering force tactics, using joint enablers, so air, maritime, special forces, and also enablers provided to us by the division that were not normally organic to us. And that was conducted at the brigade level. In parallel to that, we also needed to have the ability that if we had a eureka moment or a dilemma, which I heard about in the first presentation, that we needed to do a deep dive into, then we could take that snapshot away to a separate room and conduct a parallel war game to look at the detail at the battle group, by battalion, company, platoon, and sometime at section level. What we learned immediately when we started the game is that some aspects were difficult to play, and in this particular game it was the cyber and the electromagnetic activities, i.e. Electronic warfare, that we didn't have the knowledge and the expertise to run that as part of that particular war game. But our final requirement was that this war game was not to answer every question. It was just a snapshot in a long campaign plan to answer a myriad of questions and hypotheses for the force development of the new strike brigade.
So Graham's asked me to explain some of the underpinning thinking that then led to the technical solutions, the war games that we put in place for the Specular Strike exercise. Specular Strike was held in conjunction with a training activity, Exercise Specular. And at first we had to understand the relationships and differentiate between the two. The first point I want to make, though, is that the capabilities associated with the land components can't simply be characterized in terms of the modeling and simulation of equipments. Especially in the land components, capability is derived from the collective performance, not just of a team, but of a team of teams and teams of teams and teams within that force. So there is definitely a parallel with collective performances associated with collective training, and similar factors are involved in both the lines of development, the tactical functions. And whilst you can use collective training systems to support force development, the improvement of military capability over time, there are issues in that looking at new equipments that aren't yet in service, novel tactics associated with those new equipments, can actually confound collective training objectives set in the here and now for the current force. So the collective training activities are useful to incrementally develop capability from the current standpoint, but where you've got major changes, you actually need bespoke events. So Specular Strike was pulled to one side from the main training event. The facilities and resources were exploited, but it was held as a discrete event within that overarching umbrella. When it comes to understanding the changes you need to implement to improve the capability, they have to be expressed both in terms of the capability and the abilities that sit within it, and the missions and tasks that are being considered, and in terms of the adjustments you need to make to the fielded army to realise those changes. Adjustments which we call in the UK to our defence line of development, but which have analogues in the other countries like DOTMIL BF in the US. On DLODs, for me, these can be considered as either primary or enabling. The primary DLODs I would propose are the organisation, doctrine and concepts and equipment DLODs. They effectively characterise the capability at its maximum potential, the do better things DLODs. The others, no less important, but they enable you to realise that capability. Within force development, it's very difficult to optimise across all of these DLODs simultaneously. So this isn't proposing for the generation of force elements that one is more important than the other, rather than proposing an iterative approach by which you change major factors within the ODE, the primary DLODs, and then iterate around to make sure there are no blockers in terms of the enablers that would prevent you from realising those changes. Another consideration is to look across the kill chain, to look across the mission. Force development often takes place within stovepipes. You look at the surveillance and target acquisition capability, or the CIS, or the effectors, and you make changes within those because if you find more threat at greater range with more time advantage, or you can have an effect over greater range, it produces an advantage, a very real difference, right? Well, not necessarily. As a lapsed biologist, I'm very conscious of the concept of limiting factors. So for example, if you improve your surveillance target acquisition and you now find more threat at say 500 kilometers, whereas before it was only 250, that seems an advantage until you realize that if your effectors only have a range of 250, maybe all you're doing is providing more information to a commander that still can't do anything about the threat, and you're adding to his woes in trying to plan a way out of a challenge. So you have to look across a simple kill chain, as illustrated here, across the mission, to make sure that if you make changes in particular areas, that actually they hang together in terms of that mission and improve the mission effectiveness in itself. So the implications then for force development are that, well, when we look at the different simulation environments in which we force develop, whether it's live, virtual, or constructive simulation, we have to recognise that those different environments have different strengths and weaknesses. Constructive simulation being particularly good at vulnerability, lethality considerations, because we've modelled the kinetic effect. The live and the virtual, where you've got the military teams in the loop, are very good at looking at the decision making, the situational awareness, the command and control aspects. Similarly, the different analysis techniques have different characteristics, and you can start to map the analysis techniques and the environment and understand the relative strengths and weaknesses of those combinations of things. But the important point here is that there is no single force development analysis method that will generate sufficient evidence on a capability, team, and mission task basis. So within the land component, we believe that you actually need to take an integrated analysis and experimentation campaigning approach. We need things that lock together and look at the different facets of the capability across that mission or kill chain and understand where changes have impact, positive or negative, and whether they're confounded by other changes somewhere else in the line. Wargaming is a particularly powerful tool, in my opinion, to enable that process. First of all, wargaming is pretty unique in that it allows all of the primary DLODs to be considered in one go. Your rules or the underpinning simulation enable you to look at the kinetic effect, to look at the characteristics of the equipment. The wargamers themselves follow a doctrine, follow a way of operating. They can task organize the elements of their force as they see fit and make changes associated with it. So for those reasons alone, it's a very powerful technique. It becomes especially powerful where you run a war game and then go into another method such as warfighting experiments, live experimentation, which maybe offer a deep dive in a particular area, and you measure the change empirically and you bring that back into the tool sets, using external data to change the outcome of the game, metagaming, the glue that can link the campaigning elements together. For Specular Strike, one of the key things that drove the technical solution was the time available. The tasking arrived around about November, Christmas came and went, and we were wargaming that following January. We selected an open wargaming approach because we simply didn't have time to develop and test the SEMA rule set and or implement a closed wargaming approach. We chose RCAT for the overarching representation of the Strike Brigade. Importantly, it's the Strike Brigade within a divisional context, within the context of operating with allies. So I felt it was very important that the brigade had that bigger picture understanding of what was going on around it and how its activities were influencing other things and how other things were influencing it. The timing was very advantageous in that later last year, the RAF conducted Exercise Eagle Warrior, which also used WarCat and used RCAT and used a very similar war game and scenario. So we were able to pull lessons and understanding from that air-oriented component game. We set things up using One Brigade as the blue players. We used Dickie's staff as the green and the recorders, and we used DSTL threat wargamers who are experienced in running wargames looking at our defense scenarios to play the threat here. And the scenario itself was a development of that threat wargame, the defense wargames. So it was important to have consistency with the other activities which were underway within defense. Jeremy and Graham ran the game with the SEG staff as recorders. There was another set of activities, which I just mentioned en passant, in that the Strike Brigade were also looking at their headquarters form and function. And that experiment effectively generated the orders which were then implemented within the game the following day. But I also wanted something that would allow us to deep dive out of that higher level game so that we could understand some of the minutiae of the tactics at the subunit and unit battle group level. We didn't have anything that fitted the bill quite perfectly, so the DSTL team developed a modified off-the-shelf game, which then became called Strike, which allowed us to do that. Importantly, we used the same attritional data that underpinned RCAT, so we achieved an in-experiment consistency. And we had two of these games running in parallel with each other and with RCAT, so that we could literally deep dive either to explore alternative ways of achieving that subunit or battle group action, or to get a complementary approach study the same issues but with two different teams to see whether they came up with the same sorts of insights. Again, the red players drawn from a cohort are experienced in using the defense scenarios that had been underpinning this. This is the RCAT room that we used, just a few pictures before I hand back over Dickie, to give a flavor for what the event looked like and how it felt. This is the, on the left-hand side, the brigade staff here with the chief of staff explaining how they're about to implement the next turn. And this is very discursive. We're looking at what they're trying to achieve, what Red were trying to achieve, where the issues were, and to gain insights about the capabilities, the overmatches that were needed to be mitigated or needed to be maintained in order to explore and develop those tactics. That's Ian Gardner, who was playing Red and who posed a significant challenge to the brigade staff. This slide from Jeremy and from Graham characterising RCAT. I'm not going to talk about its characteristics. I'm not a gamer as such. Please direct any questions to them about that game itself. This is Strike, and Strike being used on the two tables in parallel. Very similar setup, smaller scale of score, of course. And they're the characteristics of the Strike game. If you've got any questions, Mike Young and Dan Lendwick are both in the audience from DSTL here today, so please address the more detailed questions about that Strike game to them. Dickie.
We run out of time. 1 minute.
55.
Okay, excellent. So, sadly, wargaming is not a leisure activity. We wanted to gain from the wargame a number of outputs. And so I'll just give you some idea, and I've been asked to talk about the analysis, about what came out, what were the outputs we got from this wargame. Immediately, within the week, we produced an initial issues letter which identified some of the instant insights we had from the game. We then spent 6 months ploughing through the data that was produced and recorded, and in July of this year we produced a large tome which gave insights to our capability branch on what capabilities to buy and evidence for balanced investment, and to our field army on how we could adjust tactics. So I'll just talk to four of the findings and then four of the lessons we got from the wargaming process itself. So first I'd like to talk about unpredictability, and it was mentioned in the first lecture today. But we as a military are trained and our culture is institutionalized to take a series of options and to bring it down to one option, which the politicians hate, because politicians like to have options open to the very last minute. What we learned from this game is that because of our psyche, we are very predictable, and the enemy can therefore anticipate what our likely moves are going to be. So we're trying to adjust our culture and make ourselves more unpredictable. Therefore, the enemy cannot anticipate what we're going to do. And we can do that by having as many options open for as long as possible during the conduct of an operation. Wellington taught us over 200 years ago, of the importance of being able to fight on ground of our own choosing. But more recently, because of the 24-hour news coverage and everything else, we have tended to forget that and react instantly to what the enemy is doing, be very reactive. But what we learned on this game is there's a huge advantage to speed of assembly in order to fight on ground of your own choosing to exploit the complex terrain to the advantage of your own capabilities and also the host nation. We also learnt, I'll speed up here, that we often overlook combat service support. And I freely admit, we got to the end of the game and we worked out we haven't used them. But we were able during latter exploitation war games to identify how we can operate differently and avoid having long, vulnerable ground lines of communication to operate more effectively. So four quick lessons on what we learned from the conduct of the war game. Firstly is the accuracy of the assumptions in. DSTL held in great esteem for the findings they produce. But when we dig deep in some of the areas, we question some of the assumptions they made. But they instantaneously came back to us and said, well, that's the information you gave us in the first place. So it's a bit of a case of crap in, crap out. We've got to make sure that the information we provide initially for the assumptions is accurate and timely. Probably the most important lesson we learned was the human nature of wargaming. If you use constructive experimentation, giving a computer a problem, or if you use LiveX, then you don't fully understand the human nature of conflict. And what is useful for wargaming, it's a cheap and efficient way of using a human red adversary to replicate some of the realities on the ground. And finally, I'll add that we in the army are instilled to win, you'll be glad to hear. It is in our culture that we must win. But when we're experimenting, we have learned that it's good to lose. Because if we lose, and we lose comprehensively, we learn genuinely from the mistakes we've made and are therefore able to do it again with the treatment that we have identified and learn how we can be more accessible when the real requirement comes for operations against the human enemy.
Perfect.